From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Tuesday when the New York Times kind of shocked the food world with a devastating review of one of the most expensive restaurants in the country and, in many ways, one of the most heralded. The restaurant's called Per Se, and for a party of four, a meal at Per Se, averaged, for the critic at least, $3,000. At the helm of Per Se is Thomas Keller, long considered a kind of deity in the American food scene. Keller is the chef and owner of French Laundry in Napa, where Anthony Bourdain is called the best restaurant in the world. In 2004, he opened Per Se in Manhattan, a kind of East Coast answer to the French Laundry. And since then, Per Se has been often highly reviewed, earning 4 stars, for example, from the New York Times. Until Tuesday. You see, Keller was considered a kind of untouchable, some said a genius, one to emulate. But Pete Wells, the restaurant critic for the New York Times, methodically tore Per Se apart with a review that criticized the food, the service, the experience, and yes, the money, the value. Wells dined there 3 times over 3 months, and he declared that Per Se is among the worst food deals in New York. And that is not all. About the service, Wells wrote, quote, "Servers sometimes give you the feeling that you work for them and your job is to feel lucky to receive whatever you get," end quote. Wells wrote that add-on charges feel like extortion. And here's just one paragraph that detailed what Wells thought of the food at Per Se. Quote, "The kitchen could improve the bacon-wrapped cylinder of quail simply by not placing it on top of a dismal green pulp of cooked romaine lettuce, crunchy and mushy at once. Draining off the gluey, oily liquid would have helped a mushroom pot pie from turning into a swampy mess. I don't know what could have saved limp, dispiriting yam dumplings, but it definitely wasn't a lukewarm matsutake mushroom bouillon as murky and appealing as bong water." Bong water. As you might guess, that became the emblematic phrase from the piece, shared often on social media, and he dropped Per Se from 4 stars to 2. Well, since Tuesday, you might say that schadenfreude has poured forth. People who can't afford to dine at Per Se have delighted in the takedown. But, you know, if you think Per Se is only meant for people who want to be sitting on a beach earning 20%, that's not exactly fair. Some of Per Se's customers are people who save up for just one special night. And what does that have to do with Rochester, or our region, by the way? Well, if even Thomas Keller can get picked apart, then just about anyone in the restaurant scene is on notice. It inspired us to put together a panel to talk about what it takes to be a consistently successful high-end restaurant. On top of that, some commenters on the New York Times site have said that Per Se has failed to take advantage of some of the shifts in high-end dining, a shift in some ways towards celebrating local agriculture. Our panel can weigh in on that and more, and we'll talk about what it might take for Rochester to move into the ranks of the destination cities for high-end dining. Let me welcome my guest for the hour. Mark Cupolo's here from Morocco. He's the chef and co-owner. It's great to have you here, Mark. How are you?
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being here. Chris Grocki's the general, I was going to say general manager and sommelier. Really, the director of operations is the formal title at Char.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Great to have you here. Alongside Chris is Mark Potter, a longtime server in fine dining establishments and a man who was happy not to be working at Per Se on Tuesday when that review came out. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Also here is Eric Hooper, a local farmer at Mud Creek in Victor, I think. Is that right?
Yep.
And a food writer, ag director over at the new Boomtown Table, the ag editor, Boomtown Table Online. And it's great to have you, Eric.
Thanks.
And Vince Press, a local food writer himself, who came to me a couple months ago and said, you know, we should think about the fact that our fine dining establishments are so much better than they were 10 years ago here. And yet, how do we get to that next level? And finally, we're having that conversation. Vince, how are you?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to start going around the table with just the question on reacting to this piece. And Mark Cupolo, you read the piece about Per Se. But what was your first reaction to reading that kind of a takedown? This wasn't Guy Fieri. This wasn't training your sights on Rachel Ray. You know, this was Thomas Keller. What did you think?
Well, I did read the piece, and I was shocked at what had happened, and was immediately trying to think what could have gone wrong at this restaurant. It really, he is one of the most respected chefs in the world, and everything I've ever read about the man is that his intensity could never let this happen. On the other hand, the piece was somewhat entertaining, you know.
Was it over the top for you?
It was over the top a little bit, yeah. I think that those are attacks that were really pretty poor in taste.
Bong water, poor in taste?
Bong water, gristle of the sea.
Yeah, the reviewer referred to lobster cooked at Per Se as, he kind of made fun of the fact that Thomas Keller in his French Laundry cookbook said that, yeah, if you poach lobster in a certain way that it's often so delicate and tender that some diners might think it's not been cooked at all. And the reviewer, Pete Wells, said, you'd never make that mistake at Per Se, where it's essentially tough, chewy, and he called it the gristle of the sea. So yeah. I thought that was in poor taste.
I really do find it hard to believe that those items were that badly prepared. It had to have been some sort of exaggeration, you know, exaggeration and a little bit for the entertainment value of his piece.
At the same time, though, what do you expect? Because we haven't heard from Thomas Keller since then.
Correct.
What do you expect Thomas Keller's reaction was privately, and what do you expect it was like to work at Per Se on Tuesday?
Well, I don't think it's probably as bad as you might think. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are a very, very well-trained, driven bunch, and they know that those dishes couldn't possibly have been that far off the mark. I really don't believe that they
But the
could.
Service got ripped.
Now that, yeah, that's a, that too. You know, I'm not really sure what went wrong there. It sounded like it might have been a little bit of a attitude problem on the, you know, if that's the style in which they operate, then, you know, that needs to be part of it.
Well, we'll get into all these various issues when it comes to high-end dining because, you know, at Rocco, for example, on the website, is there a dress code? Absolutely not, are the words even on the website. I've been to Rocco several times. I always feel very welcome. I don't show up in sweatpants, but at the same time, I feel like it's sort of open-armed, welcoming people, not having to adhere to anybody else's standard. And obviously, Pete Wells felt like it Per Se. There was a standard, and so, you know, so there's a lot to get into. Let's keep going around the table. Chris, your first reaction to the piece on Per Se.
I had the same reaction as the first three people that I cross-posted it in my Facebook feed. Ouch.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
We just, we read that as restaurant professionals, and we think we're glad that's not us that gets torn apart. We're always being analyzed and critiqued from a certain angle by the public, and we empathize when we see things like that. I agree with Mark. I think that some of that was probably just a little inflammatory on purpose.
Theatrical?
Entertainment value for sure. But that said, I think, you know, Pete Wells, a great journalist, like Mark would say, he definitely is writing from his real experience. I don't think he's trying to make anything up. I don't think he has any personal vendetta where he's trying to take Mr. Keller down. I think he just he believed that this mediocrity has creeped into very high-end restaurants, and that's something that you always have to fight against when you're serving high-end food.
Okay. Mark Potter, what was your thought, especially then from the server side? I mean, there was a lot on the service part of Per Se that got ripped apart in that article.
Yeah, you wonder, like, how do you fall that far when the standard, like you said, Thomas Keller, the gold standard, and you wonder. And I think that the value, mentioning the $3,000 price tag, it has to be perfect. Every aspect has to have perfection. Everything has to have purpose, and it just didn't happen. And that he went there on three separate occasions, you wonder what is exactly happening.
Yeah, on the service side of things for you especially, you know, he felt like it was cold, that, again, he said he felt like diners were made to feel like you're lucky to be here. You're going to take what you get. He felt like there was strong-arming because there are moments in the meal at Per Se, even with a $325 per person price tag for a prefix menu, you can upgrade from salad to foie gras, for example, for $40. You can add a truffled ravioli, a risotto, for $175. And what Pete Wells is saying is it didn't feel like an option. It felt like strong-arming.
See, you always, as a server, I want to be able to index the emotional disposition of my guests as quickly as possible. What are they here for? Is it a business meeting where they really just kind of want to be left alone and get a great steak, a great bottle of wine? Is it an anniversary where they have been saving up for this and they've heard great things and they do want the full experience? But just to try to upsell for upselling's sake, just to get your check average up, it's in poor taste, and it's offensive, and it doesn't get your diners to come back.
Well, and you know, it's interesting in that Pete Wells took down Per Se this week, but a year ago, actually I think it was 2 years ago, he wrote a review of Daniel Boulud's Daniel, in which he said, you know, this has been a 4-star establishment, and it's a 4-star meal, and it's getting 3 stars because his experience on 3 separate occasions was he thought the VIP guests got treated better than the proletariat, and he had a problem with that. As a server, what you seem to be saying is your job as a server is to try to figure out how to make it special for whatever the guests' intentions are. You know, it's almost sounds like you're trying to read every guest and try to make it great for them, whether it's business, whether it's personal, whatever they're there for. Yeah.
Sure. Yep. When I'm training a new server or server assistant, I tell people you can treat people differently so long as you treat everyone special.
Well said. Yeah. I mean, but that so it's not always the same treatment, but. We shouldn't be made to feel lesser, I guess, right? Is that sort of the what you're saying there?
Oh, no, definitely not at all. I mean, you have to, I mean, every situation is going to be a little bit different, and that's part of the job of being a server, and hopefully it comes with experience. You have to be in tune with what your guests want, especially at that price point. It has to be perfect. And as far as regards to a napkin on the floor, you have to pick that up immediately, replace it with a clean napkin. If an empty wine glass is empty and the guest doesn't want another glass, then there's no purpose for it on the table in a restaurant like Per Se. It has to be removed immediately.
Okay. Now let's get to the writers then. Eric Hooper, that review was tough, and some of the people in the food industry are saying, yeah, it was tough, and it probably reflected a negative experience, but maybe a little theatrical. As a writer, did the review ring untrue or theatrical to you?
I mean, I would agree with everyone so far that it seemed to be, it's entertainment. I mean, you know, you have a massive reader base, and you know, that's always going to influence that a little bit, I think. But it's not TMZ, you know, he's not just writing for Shock and Awe. I followed up with, like, looking at Eater.com, Slate, Grub Street, all showing a lot of empathy and similar experiences from their own reviewers going in over the past few years experience at Daniel. Slate does a great write-up, and they reference that. And where Wells seems to get a lot of credit from everybody, which I think gives him more credibility with this, is that he really is looking for value and fairness. Like, give me your price point, and I will rate you at that price point. I mean, you know, a couple of these are talking about or compare Senior Frogs, who he gave, like, a pretty decent review comparatively, but he's doing it at the experience level, the price point.
He's not going to Senior Frogs expecting it's Daniel or Per Se.
Exactly. And I think that's, to me, what gives him a deeper credibility, you know. And now all of the descriptors for some of these dishes, a little bit over the top. But when you're talking about experience, and I keep going back to what you said at Danielle, and where he says, you know, I can't fault somebody for recognizing me and treating me a certain way or giving me a VIP experience, but I can fault them for not giving that experience or a version of that experience to the tourists, the honeymooners, the splurgers, the save up once a year type people, the ones that, in his words, are going to remember that coddling for years to come, as opposed to Wells, who's on to the next project after this. So yeah, I'm sure there's a little bit of embellishment, if you will, in how he's writing the review, but it's refreshing in the sense that I think that it calls important things to light about fine dining and the experience and the cost and the value and the service associated. And in that sense, hopefully it challenges Per Se, other fine dining establishments, you know, restaurants in our region, like you're saying, to maybe take a little bit more of a look and not let the dress code define whether it's nice or not, but the food, the service, let that compel me to decide mm-hmm. what I want to pay there.
Yeah. Vince Press, again, someone who's been writing about food for a while now, you know, in general first, let's get your first take on the review. You kind of shook your head. You don't think it was over the top?
Well, the first thing that came to mind after reading it was what I think is a restaurateur's hardest job, which is consistency. Whether you're a polished fine dining establishment like that or a diner or a barbecue joint or a new brewery, it's consistency. And I see if I eat at 30 places a month because my column is a best of, that's the one thing that I go back to some of the same places again and again, and the restaurant guys will probably tell you or agree with me possibly, is there are so many variables from the products that you get and the source of the food and your staff that you're relying on your people, like any business. And consistency, that's the word that occurred to me first, is how does he let this happen, and how do you stay consistent for, I guess they've been open for 12 years.
Sure.
And it sure sounds like they haven't for the last couple.
Yeah, you know, I remember my first wedding anniversary is 2005, and my wife from the Finger Lakes, we went to dinner at Suzanne Fine Regional Cuisine in Lodi. And it's not, you know, it's on the southeast side of Seneca Lake, not a metropolis down there. The service was so good. It was so good, and it was so knowledgeable in every course that my wife literally turned to me at one point in the meal and she said, if they can do this here, mm-hmm. then there's no excuse not to have really good service everywhere. And that doesn't mean, again, treating everyone like every diner like they're a god. It means being knowledgeable, means sure. being prepared, it means being pleasant, it means, like Mark Potter's saying, kind of reading what your guests probably want. Some probably want to be coddled and have every glass of wine poured for them. Some want to handle the bottle themselves. I mean, those are just little examples, but they did it so well that we went away from that thinking, no excuses anymore.
Yeah.
You can do this if this is your ethos and you're working toward it. And we go back every year, and it has been that way every year. Now, that's one time a year. You can still say it's a small sample size.
Sure.
You're saying consistency from what you see, you know, month to month, week to week
yeah.
is the biggest challenge.
And in Rochester, certainly, there is an expectation when you're paying that kind of price in a big city. But, you know, I see in terms of servers who haven't tasted something on the menu, for instance, or if I hear one more time, you know, it's very popular from a server when I ask how something is, or a bartender that doesn't have a very good scan. So you're standing three deep at a bar and you would expect to be at least have eye contact made. And I see it all the time, and I'm in disbelief. Some of the things that nobody at this table, by the way, no establishments at this table.
Well, look, I think we can set a baseline and just explain. You know, we reached out to a number of people in the local food industry, and the really exciting thing is, you know, Mark's here, the guys from Char are here. There's a lot of establishments that could be represented today that I'd feel proud to invite, happy to talk to, because there is excitement about what's happening on the local scene. I think part of this conversation is, How do we grow that? How do we become something like, you know, we're not Manhattan. We don't have the size to be Manhattan or Chicago or L.A., but could we be Charleston? Charleston, South Carolina. People go there for the food, and I think it's a smaller city than Rochester.
Yeah. These guys do it right. I mean, right-size staffing, not skimping on the number of people, which I see all the time. A new establishment opens, and there's two servers when there should be four or two servers when there should be three, and you clearly know that economics has taken over somebody in it that's there for the long haul. But, I mean, these guys know they're getting their ingredients in the best they can, and so...
All right, well, then let's ask the folks in the food industry then. Mark Cupola at Rocco. You know, consistency, Vince is saying, is a challenge. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure he's right certainly to a degree, but tell us from an owner and a chef side, you know, how do you achieve consistency in high-end dining?
Well, a lot of it is, you know, the owner being present, and because it is ever-changing, and you do have to monitor it on a daily basis. Having longevity in your staff is extremely important, and I've had the same kitchen crew since I opened, you know, more or less.
And you opened Rocco when?
2008, mm-hmm. December 2008. I've had the same chef the whole time. I worked with him for 5 years prior to that at the Max Chop House. So I've been working with the same guy for 10 years, and his staff has really been with us the entire time, too. So that is key for me, you know. We don't change our menu very often, you know. There was a day when changing your menu as often as you could was the thing to do. I've gotten away from that completely. That's going to totally add to the consistency of your thing when they're producing day in, day out, the same menu for years on end. That's really important. Our service staff has been really consistent as well. You know, so.
And so if you have not had much turnover, it's great to say don't have a lot of turnover, but you've got to find a way to keep the really high quality staff people. And you've got to, obviously, they're staying because they feel well treated. They feel probably well paid. And so all of those things are sort of baked into that. But what's the short answer for how are you keeping the staff for the majority of your
staff?
Well,
they are treated well and they are well paid because of that consistency. Consistency leads to business, you know? I mean, if you're putting out a good product, consistent is very important. Not only the consistency of the quality of the product and service, but that consistency, I just think that part of not changing your menu very often is really important. People aren't as venturous as you might think. They want the same thing each and every time they come, you know?
Do you keep 75% of it and change 25? Do you keep 90% of it and change 10?
I'd say it's more like 90 and 10.
Okay.
Yeah.
But is there enough variation then to occasionally give someone something new to look for?
Well, that's in your specials. You know, we do probably 8 to 10 specials a day. We change maybe 3 or 4 items on the menu seasonally. But that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm comfortable with that now.
Well, it's obviously working. I mean, as our listeners know, you know, I have a toddler at home, which means if I get a chance to go out to dinner, it's usually on a Friday. We realize at 5 o'clock we can get a sitter, and it's really fun calling restaurants at 5 o'clock on a Friday to see if they have any. They usually say yes, if you can get here in 15 minutes, or, you know, like 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And your restaurant is always on that list.
Well, the size of restaurant is
very
important.
Hard for me to get in and see you, sir, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, that's a good problem to have, as they say.
Yeah. But you're right,
we'll
it's not a big
table for you every single time.
Yeah. You're different size establishments, yeah. It's true.
I think the smaller footprint restaurant is more common nowadays. The small restaurants are filled. You know, it's very important. It's important to everybody, the staff, myself, to look at a full restaurant every night. If our restaurant was 30 seats bigger, I don't think that would be happening, you know? And that leads to a little bit of a bummer of a feeling for staff and owner. And, you know, it's important that everybody stays excited, you okay. know? And a full restaurant keeps everybody excited.
All right, so Mark Cupolo at Rocco is saying that consistency, low turnover rate for staff is key to consistency in terms of service and performance for a high-end restaurant. He's also saying that, especially maybe in recent years, there seems to be demand or an expectation of customers that at least some of the menu will be there, that it's not a full-scale change all the time. Let's ask Chris, what do you think here about turnover and about consistency? How does that get defined for you?
I'll take menu consistency first. We're actually rolling out our winter menu today, so we're kind of on the opposite side of that coin. Our chef, Jeremy Nucelli, likes to refresh a good amount of the menu, probably about 50% of it, 4 times a year. And that allows him to flex his creative muscles a little bit. It allows our servers to kind of keep up on new culinary trends and new things that he might want to see or diners may want to experience. We find that it kind of it enlivens our staff to have a little bit of that change about 4 times a year. However, to Mark's point, there are anchor menu items that we have that we will absolutely keep consistent between menus because, you know, we have to. We want people to come back and see the thing that they love. We usually refresh all of our composed entrees. There's usually only 4 or 5 on our menu every single time. We do a seasonal refresh, and this time we're keeping the duck dish from the fall menu. It's a beautiful prune-glazed Rohan duck. I'm not trying to plug the menu too much here, but...
Sorry, that's what we're talking about here.
The idea there being that it was so well received, it took a while for that dish to get traction, and now we have people calling a couple times a week and saying, I'm coming here for that duck dish. Please make sure that you have it or let me know beforehand so I can reschedule my reservation. You're absolutely right. People want what they want in terms of that experience. If I had a really good time at a restaurant and I loved, you know, where I was sitting and what dish I had, I'm going to probably want that dish next time. Maybe I'll try a new wine with it, but, you know,
yeah.
I think we are all creatures of habit. I could put, you know, just 3 things on the menu and Mark would still come back every single time. So that's fantastic.
Well, I understand. I mean, I as a diner who has appreciated what, you know, Mark's been doing, for example, one night we couldn't get into Rocco. And by the way, this is not to diminish the folks next door because I love what they do. So we go to the Owl House and I had a wonderful meal. But I knew if I was lucky, we could sneak in and get a butterscotch budino at Rocco. And we did. And you let us come in and just grab a dessert. I'm sure people come in for the butterscotch budino. Tell
absolutely.
Me you're still making it.
We do make that, yeah, absolutely.
You tried to take that off the menu one time.
We took it off for a couple months.
How'd that work out?
It did not work out at all. But, you know, I mean, that's something you can never take away, and I can name 15 other items there that we can really never
take But you
take
it
away.
Off, people will complain.
They will complain.
Did people complain that the butterscotch was not there?
They did, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. So that's the Chris's point. So you've got those sort of anchors.
Sure. That butterscotch budino, one of those life-changing dishes. And I've said that to people. I brought them to Rocco and said, you know, you have to have this. And so when you've achieved a dish of that level, you do want consistency. Absolutely. And that was one of the points right. that was made in the Per Se review. You know, these classics, they don't feel tired. But then again, you know, these are things that can't change. They sustain the restaurant.
So I guess if you're going to do the classics, you have to do them well. And that's exactly right. Pete Wells was even saying that some of their classic dishes weren't well prepared. And it sounds like Mark was saying he had a hard time believing that.
When they've done it for that long, yeah.
Well, you know, the more educated the diner, I mean, any of us at this table could look at a dish and see if the sauce was slightly broken. At that level, that is a problem. You know, it is a problem.
Yeah, I'm trying to find in the review exactly where the fat had separated.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that could happen at a place like Per Se if you have been doing it that long. But again, Pete Wells will tell you that's what happened. So anyway, bottom line is, you've got the classics, you've got these core items, you've got to continue to do them well. And then when it comes to turnover, how important is turnover at Char, for example?
It's important. We want to keep the same people. You know, we've got a fairly young staff, and, you know, young people tend to move around the country a little bit. We've got people that come in and out of school, and we'll have different work schedules because of that. But that said, that's a minority of the staff. We've had a lot of consistency, you know, a lot of people that have been with us from day one, and we value that highly. I completely agree with that.
Let me just ask Mark Potter, a longtime server in local establishments. So have you been able to sort of stick around the same place? Have you moved around? And tell me about that.
I kind of came with the building when the owners changed hands. I was able to keep my job and happy to do so. So yes, I've been working for the Strathallan Hotel since 2002. So quite a while.
Okay, and you're happy to stay in the same place?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So before I get to your phone calls, because I see the phone's starting to ring, a good host should mention the phone number if you want to join the conversation on what it takes to be a consistently successful high-end dining town like Rochester is becoming, I think in large part, thanks to the kinds of people who are at our table today. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you want to read the column in which Pete Wells was accused of murdering Thomas Keller in the New York Times this week, we've posted it on our Twitter feed. It was a brutal takedown. So, but that's what we're discussing. And before I get to those phone calls, let me just ask the writers then, you know, slightly different takes on Anchorman. I mean, I think some agreement that there has to be some similarity in a menu, some consistency there, with maybe some exploration as well. Eric Hubert?
Yeah, I like both. Almost to a fault, at least in my wife's opinion, sometimes I'm a creature of habit. And a lot of that is because whether it's a menu item or service, like if I'm going to watch football on a Sunday, I'm going to walk to Merchant's Grill because Kate's behind the bar and she's going to be the best bartender on Sunday in town. And there are those things and food as well. If Red Dove Tavern in Geneva ever takes their Thai veggies off of the menu, my wife will probably call up Rune specifically and say, what are you thinking? So there is that. On the other side, I do love new things. I love going to the same place and trying new things. I love going to new places and trying new things. I think that's important. And I think it's specifically important and necessary to have that balance when we're talking about a city like Rochester, and obviously you got to include the Finger Lakes, in becoming a fine dining hub. Because I think that the most important thing that we can leverage to make that happen is our regional fare. That's what Savannah, Georgia is. That's what Charleston is. It tastes like Charleston.
That's what Blue Hill Stone Barn is.
That's what Dan Barber's doing. I mean, he is the antithesis of this of the Per Se review. This tastes like the region, and we are one of the most fortunate, biodiverse, unique agricultural regions in the country for chefs and restaurateurs to highlight. So that can be done with consistency in menu. That can be done with a diversity of menu. It needs to be done both ways. I mean, you know, we've got Kindred Fare, FLX Table, both opening up and have opened in Geneva, both highly focused on like hyper-regional, highly rotational menu. And it's all because we are going to cook with what we can get right here, right now, and come up with something so that you know that this is what the Finger Lakes taste like. You know, but there's also the consistent side. I think that goes both ways. But as far as this region growing to and then sustaining itself as a destination for eating, I think that it'll have to have that balance. It has to have the idea of, like, I know that I can come here and with the cultural background get some pretty awesome Italian cuisine, and I can get good proteins, good meat, but I can also try new things. And, you know, how many chefs are putting kohlrabi on their menu when it's in season, things like that. And that's exciting too. And I think that's what we're going to need as a region to become what we want to be.
Okay. Vince Press, how do we get to that next step then?
I love the formula of keeping the, some of the same items on the menu, whether it's 90-10 or 50-50. I think I love that formula, and the specials, I think, do the trick. And now, of course, with craft beers, craft cocktails, you can lure people in with some of those and mix those up as well. But whether it's the octopus at Rocco, which is on the menu all the time, and it's a destination for people, or the burger at Good Luck, if you can hook somebody with those. And it's all about sharing, too, I think. Somebody will get the burger, somebody will get what's new, and try everything. And so that mix is a great formula to be.
All right. Our phones are lit up across the board, and I'm late for a break. So what I want to do is get a very short break in and come back with your phone calls as we continue to talk about the high-end dining scene and how it can continue to improve, to put Rochester, sort of in that cliche, how do you put it on the map? Well, we're not that far away. There's so much going on locally, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. And we're talking to some professionals in the industry. You just heard Vince Press and Eric Cooper. They're here on the writer's side. Vince, where can we find your work?
Rochester Magazine and the DNC every month. I'm in the mood for is the name of the column.
Okay, Eric Hubert with Boomtown Table. And if you missed the recent program on the launch of Boomtown, it's brand new. It's online, boomtowntable.com. And you are the ag editor?
Yep.
All right, very good. So we can read your work and some of your edited work as well. There, he's also a farmer. He's over at Mud Creek and Victor. So he comes from a number of perspectives. Chris Grocki, the director of operations at Char. What's the full name of Char? I always just say Char.
Char Steak and Lounge.
Yeah, see, thank you for correcting me. Char Steak and Lounge.
That's important because you don't want to confuse it with the one in Connecticut or New Jersey.
That's right. So Chris is here from Char Steak and Lounge. And Mark Potter, longtime server as well. Been hanging out at the Strathallen since 2002. And also here is Mark Cupolo from Rocco on Monroe, technically on Monroe Avenue.
Monroe
right?
Ave. Yeah.
All right, very good. Short break. All the phones lit up, and we start to work through your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what happens when an aging parent is dying and one of their children has special needs? What happens when that parent and child are going to be separated for the first time and a child with special needs? Well, the family doesn't know where the care is going to come from. A new documentary explores that question, and local agencies explore it every week. It's part of our Dialogue on Disability next hour.
President Obama says he wants every student to have access to a quality computer science class. What might that look like?
Getting their heart to sing because it was their creation and they built something that was never built before. That's the most exciting time in a young student's computer science career is when they finally finish their first project and want to just shout to the rooftop that this is mine.
Building a better computing class later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we have touched a nerve. Let's start with Joe in Rochester. First up, go ahead, Joe.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing today?
Good. Very good.
Just thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to do a little comment on the per se review. I've had a privilege of cooking in fine dining when I lived in Chicago and worked for a place that's quite mirrored to per se. I worked at a restaurant called True. And one of the things I wanted to comment is the lack of consistency that was shown in that review is kind of goes against everything a Michelin-starred restaurant is rewarded for. And it also hits on the fact that that level of cuisine is quite unsustainable from the waste it creates to, the dollar amount that's requested. As in the review had said, initially a tasting menu was $150 and now it's $350. For a non-tangible product, it's a very high price point for it. And so your consistency and your perfection has to be there to add value to that long-standing tangible item you're consuming. And so it's kind of shocking when you see a Thomas Keller restaurant receive that because he's known for his consistency and his perfection. It's kind of a comment I had for the per se side of things and what Rochester can be for a dining capital moving to Rochester from Chicago. You kind of wondered where the gems were, and once you found them, you realized, wow, Rochester has a heck of a dining community and a great resource with the Finger Lakes so close to cornucopia of quality products. I think Rochester has fantastic potential to go even more beyond what it already has to offer. Will it ever be a white tablecloth town? I don't think so, and I think most cities are no longer white tablecloth cities. Trends in dining are going more casual, upscale casual, things that are more approachable for your dining customer and somewhere where you can actually turn a profit margin as a restaurant owner. Those are just kind of my comments I had. And, Boomtown Table, you guys are doing a great job. It's great coverage.
Thanks.
Everyone at your roundtable here are fantastic at what they do, so thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for the phone call. And on that last point, that's what I want to throw at the panel, because we've had a number of people mention that, how things have changed a bit. And we have some old schoolers who kind of lament the fact that you could go out to Rocco or Char or pick any number of Lenta, Revelry, so many more, that you're going to see people wearing jeans more often than you'll see a suit and tie. And it didn't always used to be like that. So Mark Cupolo at Rocco, does that, does that matter to you? You know, you have that sign on the website that says, absolutely not, no dress code. You know, you want people to feel comfortable.
Yeah, it's true. I don't think it's dress code has anything to do with it at all. Even when I was in Boston working for Jasper White, the finest of fine dining in Boston, he had a sign right in the window that said, no jackets or ties allowed. You know, so he set that with me early on, that it isn't really about that. You know, it really, for the restaurateur, it's about the food and the service. And, people got to be comfortable. You know, we're a cramped spot there. You know, it's hot in there. Sometimes it's cold in there. But the last thing you really want is a tie and a suit on.
That probably does not mean you've got diners routinely showing up in sweatpants.
No. But we certainly wouldn't frown upon that at all. You know, I've had some people ask me about that sweatpant thing. You know, can we come from a workout situation?
They asked you?
Yeah, sure.
Really? And you say?
Sure, fine. Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Okay, Chris Grocki, if they call Char and say, I'm coming to dinner from a workout.
I'd say you never know who you're going to meet, so maybe wear some nice pants, you know? But no, seriously, we're a hotel. I mean, we're the epitome of, you know, kind of people, you know, kind of coming from all sorts of directions. Do we get people that come directly from a workout across the lobby? Yes, we absolutely do. And those people will sit at the bar and they'll have a beer and they'll have some, you know, of our Asian-inspired chicken wings and be perfectly content there. That said, our clientele seems to kind of want to dress itself up. We don't have a dress code, and yet we see a lot of people that are in full suits and ties, cocktail gowns. We see a little bit of everything, and I think it's just whatever experience the people are going for, they want to know that they'll fit in to a certain extent. So that would be my advice, I suppose. Just don't make yourself feel awkward. If you're going to feel a little awkward in sweatpants, like, you know, don't wear them. If you're going to feel overdressed, if you're wearing a suit and tie, don't wear that.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, Pete Wells reviewed Pearl and Ash in Manhattan a couple of years ago, and he was critical, sort of snarkily critical, of the fact that the owner, you know, is wearing fancy T-shirts. And Pete says he's kind of an old schooler. He likes a little bit of the pageantry. So, but that does seem to be a shift. I mean, I definitely think 20 years ago you'd see more shirt and ties at fine dining establishments. I think everyone's nodding. Vince, does it matter to you? I mean, is this an issue to you as a writer, as someone who experiences fine dining?
Well, I do think, as a caller said, the trend has gone certainly more casual even the last 5 or 6 years. If you look at any of the celebrity chefs in their last one or two restaurants they opened after their flagship higher-end place, they've all been burger, barbecue, maybe ethnic, whether it's Vegas, whether it's Michael Simon's burger places in Cleveland. I think the trend indeed has gone a little more casual, which I love. I love getting great food, and it's the basis of my article. I find the best of, whether it's poutine at a food truck or whether it's, you know, Anthony Bourdain, you mentioned. One of the things you could tell by his face a few years ago, one of the things he loved the most, I think, was eating ramen under a blue tarp somewhere in Japan, and it was raining, and he was drinking a canned beer, and he just said, this is one of the greatest things I've ever had anywhere, and it had nothing to do with attire, it had nothing to do with who was working
He loved the barbecue in Kansas City, great barbecue town. I think, I don't want to misquote the name, I think it's Oklahoma Joe's, it's out of a gas station.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the best, he said. You know, it's a gas station.
Yep.
And I was there, and there was a line out the door, and I'm going, wow.
Yeah, not to diminish Char, because they're a very pleasant anomaly, so to speak, where amongst some of the trends in casual dining. But you really can, I think, feel comfortable no matter who you are, Char.
Okay, and before I get back to the phones, real briefly, sort of to Joe's point, the question of what is fine dining? You know, we had someone listening on the other side of this building just sent me a note saying, you know, how do you even define it? And before the program began, I was talking to someone saying, does high-end dining just mean price point? Does it mean sommelier? We see fewer sommeliers, but we still see it. Do people want that has that expectation of what people want changed? Chris, has that changed?
The expectation of what people want from a som, I think, is probably different than it used to be. In a fine dining era, you know, I try to play it as simply as I can, table side, until I do what Mark Potter said and, you know, kind of read exactly what the table is about when it comes to that. A lot of people will just say, leave me alone, I want to make a selection from the book, and that's, you know, perfectly acceptable. And I would say, you know, just whenever you pick it, let me know, I'll grab the bottle for you. And that's when they kind of calm down, because there's a certain pretense associated with wine service table side that we really don't want to get into. That said, the whole purpose of a som is to help you get a good wine for your money and with the food that you're eating, right? So if I can, you know, play to that expectation a little bit, I'll do it every single time. We don't want people to feel that they have to spend a certain level on a bottle of wine to get sommelier service. We don't want them to feel as though the service overall has to be very formal. In that sense. So, yes, people are, some people, I guess the best way to break this down, some people want the show and they want the experience, they want the pomp and the circumstance and the serviette and the perfectly decanted bottle of wine. I like that when I go out. I think there's something to be said for, you know, watching those technical aspects of service. But most of the time, you're just there to relax and have a good time. And so we need to be able to play both sides of that.
Yeah, there was a reviewer, I would say a reader to the New York Times. They published some of their more than 900 comments on the Per Se review. And one of them mentioned how things at Per Se seem to be focused on what they call it the show, the theater of the kitchen. And the writer said, you know, at best, some of New York's so-called best restaurants put on a good, albeit a show. Me, I just want some honest cooking. So, again, it sort of depends on what people want.
Exactly.
It's interesting that that may be shifting. So, all right, let me get back to the phones here because, again, we are filled up on the lines. So, let's see here. Steve in Fairport. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, guys. How are you? I grew up in Rochester. I worked in some of the classics, Changing Scenes and Pittsburgh Tavern, moved away and worked in a lot of hotels in the South and back in Rochester. A quick few comments. People ask me, Steve, where do you go? Where do you eat out? And I'm not fussy. I enjoy good food. I like a good atmosphere. But I get so disappointed a lot of times when I do dine out. Some of my favorites, I love steak tartare. I've had it at Char. I know Jeremy buys Wagyu occasionally. So I will eat it there. I just was listening to one of your guests about ramen. It's funny because you could go to New York City. One of my favorite places is Toto Ramen on 8th and 9th Avenue and spend literally $20 and probably have the best ramen you've ever eaten in your life. A lot of it is education, and a lot of people don't know what they're eating. You know, I went out a week ago, and I enjoy rabbit, but I went to an Italian place in East Rochester, and it wasn't good. And the response, somebody said, well, why would you order rabbit at an Italian restaurant? Well, it's on the menu. If it's on the menu, do it and do it right. And one other thing I talk when I hear people going into the restaurant business, they have a concept, then they look for a location. To me, I would look for the location, do your demographics, and build your business around the people or the area that you're in if you want to make money. That's what I would do to be successful. If you want to be successful and you want to make money in the business. Now, if you're doing it for a hobby, then that's a whole nother thing.
I think most of them are not doing it for a hobby. No, I'm with you on that, Steven. Thank you for the phone call, but let me just ask the two restaurants represented then. Octopus, for example. You don't do it unless you know how to do it, right? He talked about rabbit. He's saying, you know, if you're going to put something on the menu, be prepared to do it very, very well. Fair, Mark Cupolo?
Yeah, very fair. You know, I mean, everything should be done very, very well. And once again, consistently, you know. And the chefs are always trying to tweak their thing. I mean, we changed our octopus 2 years in to a totally different octopus. And I was then all of a sudden much happier about it. And I think our guests were much happier about it. So there's always improvements along the way. But the quality, you know, it just has to stay. You know, there's just so many factors. They're quite simple, but a lot of places don't achieve it. Hot food is very important to me. That's not always managed. Now, one of the beauties of Rocco is that the stove where the food is cooked is literally anywhere from 10 to 25 feet from where you're sitting. So we have a beautiful thing with hot, hot food there. And I think that's very important. That's part of the consistency thing for me. The octopus, yeah, it's got to be done well, you know. I mean, that's just sort of a given, you know.
Well, I mean, I would think so. If you're going to order something as interesting, and sometimes, say, unusual, I guess, compared to most restaurants, be prepared. But even a steak, I get a steak at Char, it better be really good, Chris. I mean,
you're going to a steakhouse, you're paying a good amount. Well, yes, it should be good.
Yes. So it doesn't have to just be rabbit or octopus. It should be really, really specialized, really, really done well, yeah?
Incredibly well. When that's your focus, you know, if you're talking about Italian food, you know, regional cuisine, if you're talking about steaks, it doesn't matter. Those should be the best items on the menu, sure. When you have kind of the off thing on the menu, a rabbit dish in an Italian restaurant, then, you know, you're entering into some territory where I suppose as a diner you're taking a risk. But if it's on the menu, that means that someone in the kitchen had an idea that they could do this well, so they should be able to execute.
All right, let's see here. Waiting to jump in has been Patrick in Rochester. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yes, with the not to introduce a cloud here, but however, with the raise in the minimum wage, how does that work out for the restaurant business?
The raise in the minimum wage. Yeah,
yeah? Right, in New York, yeah, from the whatever it is to whatever it will be for the servers.
Well, thanks for the call, Patrick. That's kind of a multi-tiered question, because what happened last year was a raise for the tipped workers from $5 an hour to $7.50. Is that right, gentlemen?
Mm-hmm. That's
okay,
correct.
So $5 to $7.50, and then on top of that, I think what he's asking about is the proposed minimum wage increase to $15 across the board. Now, a lot of servers in high-end establishments are making a lot more than minimum wage to begin with. And I think to some degree, Patrick, I don't mean to cop out here. It's a whole different discussion because, you know, Chris Crocky, tell me if I'm wrong here, but before the program started, we were talking about the fact that if you go to Manhattan, there is it's not widespread, but there's maybe a small but growing trend of restaurants, even high-end restaurants.
The service included, right.
Taking tip optioned out completely. And mm-hmm. the question is that going to become the norm across the board in restaurants? And is that baked into the minimum wage discussion?
Well, that's a discussion that will be ongoing. We're taking a wait and see approach. Our hospitality group has no plans to implement a service included approach right now. We believe that diner and service relationship is better for the fact that there's kind of a direct tip policy. I think it's magical when it happens correctly. What other industry can you depend on the discretion of the people that are doing business with you in order to maintain your business model? So that's kind of one of the most unique things about our industry. To change it to match all the other industries is one way, I guess, of correcting some inequality. But that said, we're gonna take just a backseat approach on this and see what happens. And you know, if it eventually looks like that's a better idea, then we'll start to do it in a very logical way. But for right now, we're good.
Will you come back next month and we talk about this?
Sure.
I'm gonna drag you back here, Chris, because that is a whole separate discussion. We've had some emails from listeners, Tim in Pittsford, a few others asking about tips and various levels, and that is a separate discussion. We're going to do that next month, and so we'll get back there. We got just a couple of minutes left. Vince Press, you've heard a lot this hour. You wanted to talk about how to take this town to the next level. Give me the short prescription based on what you've heard and where you see this town going.
Well, I'll interject with one story, which I'll make my point, and it's about Mark. I think I told you when I lived in Virginia 15 plus years ago and Mark owned the Victor Grilling Company, I had a venison dish with spatzel and red cabbage, and I still remember it to this day. Now we're talking about his newer project, a restaurant, and everybody loves it, and it's great. And the thing that has been in his formula is him, the ownership, the chef. And that makes all the difference in the world. So people have been going there, even as I told you, when Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks come to town, they always mm-hmm. go back there. It's consistency. We can do it, and I think it's certainly changing, and we're seeing more and more restaurants with that put, they're vested in their staff, they're vested in where they're getting their products.
It's amazing how many times I will see Art Rogers, Mark Cupolo, Josh and Jenna Miles are ubiquitous. They're everywhere somehow. When you see the people who own and are cooking your meals and they see you directly, it does make a difference.
Absolutely.
And you have that relationship that you're building. Eric Hubert, where are we going next here? What can change?
To echo something that Chris said earlier, and it's just a simple concept that we all know, going out, dining out, I think, is probably one of the ultimate sensory experiences. You know, we whether it's the companionship that we have, the friends that we're going out with, the service that we get, the food that we get, the drinks that we drink, it all plays to that. And it's a continued investment that we save up for, or that you know, that we cherish, that we treasure, whether we are people that have the means to do it whenever we want, or whether it's a once or twice a year thing. It's such a important part, a paradigm to our culture and subculture as a region. And that's where I think that on the food side, like I said before, I think that Rochester and the Finger Lakes more and more and more is and needs to continue to start tasting like Rochester and the Finger Lakes. The wine, I mean, it's a horrifying percentage of wine that's from New York State on all these menus and stuff. And I think that the more that we can make this region taste like this region, the more people are going to come to it.
Well, here's a note from a listener in the Finger Lakes. Love your show today. A much needed distraction from the political onslaught lately. I think once in a while we do need to change it up, and we try to do that on this program. And so thanks for that comment. And for the many callers who couldn't get through, again, we will continue these discussions because the community really responds to what the professionals are doing, what the writers are doing. Eric Cooper, Vince Press, thanks for taking the time and joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris and Mark from Char, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mark Cupolo, Rocco. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Steak, octopus, butterscotch, Bedino. You have your marching orders for the weekend, and more connections next.